Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
The Ultimate Terror returns. Slaughtered at Sundown, Haunted House and Hayride. Open weekends now through October 29th. Located on Romeo Plank Road, just north of 32 Mile in Armada.
Motor City Riff.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much and welcome, everybody. As I've said so many times before, this show goes all across the country, all across the world via the internet. So those of you who are listening in Phoenix or Denver or Miami or Seoul, Korea or Singapore, I mean, it's not Singapore, where's Shanghai? We have a listener. There are a few people listening in Japan. Our pal in Jacob in Finland. Mexico City. You are not going to understand from, you're not going to be able to understand, being so far away, the absolute elation that's going on in our city with the Detroit Tigers, the baseball team. I'll have to tell some of you across the world, the Detroit baseball team, the traditional team that's been in this city for over 100 years, won the American League pennant. It's the first one since 1984, so there's great joy in Tiger Town. And then, as if inspired by the Tigers' incredible sweep of the series, they just played with the Oakland A's and the incredible ninth inning two-out home run that won it for the Tigers. The Detroit Lions, the football team, won as well. That doesn't happen very often, does it? So for the Tigers, it is on to the World Series with either the St. Louis Cardinals, who I'd like to see them play, mainly because it's a traditional team, and let me see if I can remember any of my history. Well, they beat the Cardinals in 1945 and 1934. Were there other series with the Cardinals? Anyway, I never liked all these I must make this into a sports show, so I'm going to stop right now. I never liked all these expansion teams anyways. I mean, when you have hockey teams in Florida and Southern California and all that, I'm pretty traditional. So I know the Mets have been around for, 45 years at least? Still, I'd like to see the old-timers, the Detroit Tigers, the St. Louis Cardinals. All right. But if you're just tuning by, this is not a sports show. This is a public affairs show where we talk about the political, social issues of the day and how we all relate to them. I have my views. You have your views. My views are extraordinarily strong. I don't understand it. Sometimes some of you, you write the program director and say, Peter Harvey's that man. Were you a tattletale when you were in school? But this is set up to do this. And what we have... See, I get to speak a lot more than you because I'm the host. But you get to speak. So if you disagree with me, 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. I mean, feel free to complain. It's just a waste of your email, though. Since I've been here doing this a long time, management knows what I'm all about, and they know that the majority of WRIF listeners agree with me. Some don't. That's fine. Doesn't matter. People throughout this station have a variety of political views, and they make them known in many different ways. Now, last week when we were doing this show, some of you may remember, Vietnam, there you go, it's getting close to that. An Iraq veteran, a veteran of the Iraq War, called in to say very frequently what you hear from some of the remaining defenders, political defenders, politicians who are defending the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, say that the media never presents the good stuff, only the bad stuff. Well, I don't know where the good stuff is. The Iraq veteran said that when he was over there, and you got to remember, a lot of men and women went over with the best of intentions. Some of them have, as we know, have performed very badly. Very, very badly indeed. And I think of some of the scandals about all of this. But our caller said that they had, his unit, I don't remember what branch, but so let's say the Army, his Army unit had brought, I think it's its shoes, and how grateful the people were. And I don't even remember too much my response. I think I said, and it's even more emphasized by what we've learned over this last week about casualties among the Iraqis, that these little gestures, no matter how heartfelt they are and how generous of spirit they may be, it doesn't do much to counterbalance this enormous mountain of corpses that have piled up because that George W. Bush and the rest of Bush Co. lied about the reasons for going into Iraq. This new study from one of the world's most prestigious universities, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, said that there are 654,000 deaths tied to the Iraq War. It's a toll far higher than most estimates. But the people that did it are epidemiologists, people that look at the effect on whole populations of, for instance, epidemics, and they have research methods. Now, the first thing, of course, that, as you can imagine, Bush Co. and all the spokespeople said, that's preposterous. The figure's preposterous. And as usual, they don't say why. They just declare it to be preposterous. Whereas the people from Johns Hopkins, they defended their study by and their research methods. And they say 654,000 Iraqis have died because of the U.S. invasion and occupation and insertion into what is now a civil war, with thousands of people on each side of the Iraqi side dying. 2,600 Iraqi civilians killed in September. So, well, here it says, where is the thing? It says, gunshots emerge. Can you imagine that? As the leading cause of death, accounting for 56% of the total. Airstrikes, car bombs, others explosions, each accounted for 13 to 14%. Almost 60% of the deaths were among males 15 to 44. Yeah, that's pretty understandable. So this is not inconsistent. I misspoke myself earlier and said Vietnam. In Vietnam, there was 2 to 3 million. I mean, the spread of civilian deaths was so mammoth that they depends on who you talk to. But nobody says it's less than 2 million. But 2 to 3 million civilians were killed because, again, another war began on the basis of a lie in 1965. And you go back to the Korean War, a million Korean civilians die. And we have taken it for granted, probably since World War I, but certainly since World War II, that the United States sends troops all across the world to fight these wars that turn out to be these enormous slaughters, and increasingly the United States barely gets out of them. I mean, yeah, the United States did all right to defeat Saddam Hussein, Manuel Noriega, who else? This little country of Grenada. But When there is an in-place resistance, the United States takes lots of casualties, and the civilian populations take extraordinarily high casualties. And usually that it's either a stalemate. There's usually a cut and run, like in 1953 in Korea or 1972 in Vietnam. And I'll tell you, that's what's being talked about right now. This we're never leaving. You got generals saying that the United States troops are going to be there through 2010. But just as in Vietnam, when Richard Nixon said that there would never be a defeat, there would never be a withdrawal, Henry Kissinger was pretty much cutting a deal with the Chinese that there would have to be a little interval before the United States would withdraw its troops. So it didn't look politically bad. Well, I don't even think I have that, but it's something like 97% of British troops think that the only reason that they are in, the British troops now, are in Iraq and in Afghanistan is for political reasons, domestic political reasons. So Tony Blair will not have to accept a massive political defeat because of his incredible error of tying his fortunes to the lies of George W. Bush, the miscalculations, and however else you want to describe it. But the majority of American people believe that, so maybe we shouldn't even spend too much time on that. A couple interesting things, though, that I thought. And it did, last week, what was on last week on 60 Minutes? Some big expose. It was another book, right? It was an. You got a. Two-thirds of the American people saying that you have a government that whose policies they don't support. Maybe this is beating a dead horse, as they say. But tell me, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. If you want to email, call talkyes@yahoo.com. But here's another one on 60 Minutes tonight. They have some unconstitutional department called Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. Now, the Constitution, the First Amendment, specifically says, before it guarantees any of us our rights, it says that Congress shall make no law establishing religion. So this, again, is a twisting, a trashing, a shredding of the Constitution on the part of Bushko. And they do this for what? Because they're so deeply religious. This is a party of faith. This is a party of moral values. We know that, right? Even though there's all these congressmen having to resign for sex scandals and corruption and more as the weeks go on. But deeply felt are these religious values? Well, it's a load of crap, as usual. This is a New York Times summary of this. His book says Bush aides dismissed Christian allies. Well, what a headline. A former deputy director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives is charging that many members of the Bush administration privately dismiss its conservative Christian allies as boorish and call them nuts. The former deputy director, David Kuo, an evangelical Christian conservative, makes the accusations in a newly published memoir, Tempting Faith, an Inside Story of Political Seduction. And it's about his frustration with what he described as the meager support and political exploitation of the program. Now, we're paying for this. You and me, the taxpayers, we're turning our money over to conservative Christian community-based initiatives whose main, well, I was going to say, it depends on who they are. One of the main purposes of the organizations that are getting our money in a secular nation where religious establishment is prohibited by the foundation document are ones whose main concern is getting converts to evangelical Christianity. And this is exactly why the Founding Fathers put this prohibition in there. Now, Mr. Cole writes, national Christian leaders received hugs and smiles in person and then were dismissed behind their backs and described as ridiculous, out of control, and just plain goofy. So do you hear that? Here is the man that's posing as the man of Christ, and all of his pals are saying, you're goofy, you're out of control, you're ridiculous. I mean, how much more of that stuff, the word I can't say on the air, are you going to eat? I mean, how bad, how stupid are these people? That's why they have so little respect for you. Let's see. Well, many conservative Christians considered President Bush, quote, a brother in Christ. Mr. Kuo writes, for most of the rest of the White House staff, evangelical leaders were people to be tolerated, not people who were truly welcomed. The political affairs office, headed by Karl Rove, was especially eye-rolling. You know, people roll their eyes, the book says. It says staff members in that office knew the nuts were politically invaluable, and that was the extent of their usefulness. Without naming name, the book says staff members complained that politically involved Christians were annoying, tiresome, or boorish. So that's what they think of you. They talk about the Lord, and what? They're just, you know, see you as a... as a base, right? So they got to pay you off financially. So they take the rest of our tax dollars and give you some of it. And what they've actually been able to do, and talk about political seduction, is go into impoverished inner cities who have had all these social programs cut to begin with under Bush Co., and then promise them more money through directly to their churches because they're involved in anti-drug programs or in some way helping the poor. And you can understand why these pastors, who are just frantic of what's happening in poor communities and poor minority communities, and they say, well, look, we never got anything directly from the Democrats because they follow the Constitution, but hey, we need this money to carry out our program, so we'll take it. And then you find some of them saying, well, yeah, maybe these Republicans aren't so bad because their votes are being paid for, bought and sold with tax dollars. So and that's the strategy, because Every one of these elections, even if you don't agree with me that the 2000 and 2004 election was stolen, it was so close that you had to start thinking in half percentage points. And if you can move a core Democratic Party constituency away in half a percentage point or one percentage point, it's money well spent. Well, particularly since it's not your money, it's taxpayer money, right? All right, let's turn a little now to this race in Michigan. Dick DeVos, the Republican, far right-wing conservative and way far right-wing, much more so than he has portrayed himself in the $18 million that's been spent on his ads to portray him as a businessman. Now he's got his shirt off. He's got his sleeves rolled up. He's ready to get Michigan working again. And somehow putting the blame for the wreckage that his corporate buddies have created in General Motors and Ford and Delphi and corporations like that. Somehow it's Jennifer Granholm, the current governor's fault. I don't get this. So if Dick DeVos is such a great businessman, why doesn't he take over General Motors? and tell him how to run it, or did he not do so well in his company? Now, there's a great article by my pal Kurt Guyette, the news editor of the Metro Times. You can go to metrotimes.com. Actually, or you can go to my website. It's right on there. PeterWerbe.com. PeterWerbe.com. Go down a little. You'll see all this stuff about Dick DeVos and how he has spent 80% self-funded. I mean, that's how much money these people have. So they've spent about $18 million. In the meantime, Jennifer Granholm has spent $2.5 million on TV ads because that's what the Democratic Party has. Kurt Guyette in the October 4th Metro Times says the agenda has been clear-cut. Tax cuts that primarily benefit corporations and the wealthy. Tell me, I mean, this is Bush Coast at the state level. Industry deregulation, so they can just do what they want, charge what they want. School privatization. They hate public schools. They want to be able to get these charter schools in that don't teach secular education. They want to turn everything over to the corporations, and they want to destroy the teachers' unions. Again, here you have this right-wing strategy to destroy the financial and electoral base of the Democratic Party. So maybe they won't even be able to spend $5 million on an ad if they don't get the Democrats don't get donations from unions. The promotion of so-called traditional values that cover everything from undermining the rights of gays to recriminalizing abortion to breaking down the wall separating church from state. This is DeVos. Opposition to environmental movement and organized labor and affirmative action and cuts in funding to social services. The DeVos family has been the epicenter of this movement in Michigan. It started with Richard DeVos Sr., who's worth about $3.5 billion. And they give out millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars to far right-wing groups to fund them. And they gave so much money to the Republican Party in 2000. And who was it, either the father or Dick, that was offered a ambassadorship? Don't know. Long article. But well worth reading. And you can read it online. Now, here's DeVos. This is in LSJ.com, Lansing State Journal. Republican gubernatorial candidate Dick DeVos told a Catholic radio program that he'd, quote, be thrilled if the 1973 Supreme Court decision upholding a woman's right to an abortion is overturned. Before the decision of Roe v. Wade, Michigan had a law that banned all abortions except to save a mother's life. And, of course, what happened in that regard was that if you were wealthy, you could get an abortion because you went to a doctor and the doctor said, oh, yes, the woman's life is in danger. And then he performed an abortion for an extraordinarily high amount of money. The poor, the working class, of course, they continued to get abortions where in Latin America, where I believe still every country in Latin America, with the exception of Cuba, abortion is illegal. And I think punishable by a felony, every single country other than Cuba. And, of course, abortions go on, except they're extraordinarily dangerous. Women die, and it does not cut into the amount of abortions that people have at all. Or maybe it does. I shouldn't say that for sure. So, because that's what these people are about, the compulsory pregnancy movement. There's nothing about pro-life. There's nothing that connects them with the authentic pro-life sentiment. In terms of abortion, they're all about forcing women, having the political state run almost exclusively by men, forcing women to have babies that they do not want to have. It's cute, isn't it? And this is what one of the things that Dick DeVos is all about. Now, DeVos said Thursday on an interview on this Catholic talk show called Cresta in the Afternoon. It's on Ave Maria Radio, which means then, see where this is all tied in together with these far right wing billionaires, is with Domino's guy, Tom Monahan. He says, as soon as Roe v. Wade is overturned, says DeVos, which I think we all pray that it will be, will revert back to Michigan law. That we would go back to that standard, I'd be thrilled about it. DeVos said Tuesday during a debate with Governor Jennifer Granholm that, quote, our current laws as it relates to abortion in Michigan are sufficient. Whoa, what's going on here? For, again, for you right-wingers, a few of you still around, supporting this kind of statist oppression, during the debate with Democratic Governor Jennifer Granholm, Dick DeVos, the Republican candidate, says, quote, our current laws as it relates to abortion in Michigan are sufficient. So you go, oh, this guy's not an extremist. He doesn't want to roll back abortion. He's a businessman. Maybe he'll put Michigan back on its feet. But then he tells a Catholic radio program that when Roe v. Wade is overturned, and I think we all pray that it will be, that I will be thrilled about it. So this guy is what? A liar. What a surprise, huh? Peter Werby here with you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And let's see, let's take some calls. Here's Danielle in Farmington Hills. Danielle, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how's it going?
Going great. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, you know, I'm starting to look forward to every Sunday, man. You make a lot of sense, man. Just want to point out a few things about Dick DeVos. I had actually been listening to him on a couple of Detroit radio stations, you know, doing some interviews in the morning radio hour, and I just think it's kind of funny how he says that he's all about jobs and job creation, but you know, if you really look at the numbers, there was one radio station that brought up the point that Jennifer Granholm had actually, you know, produced 24,000 jobs. And he was like, well, you know, you can't start from a negative number and work your way up and say that there's a positive. I mean, it was just dumb. He actually admitted himself that, yes, at one point there was 100,000 jobs that were lost, and we're up to 80,000 jobs that are lost in the state of Michigan, which, you know, I just thought was funny because you're sitting there going, okay, now this just came out of your mouth. You just said that, no, she did not create any jobs yet. You're talking about the fact that it went from 100,000 to 80,000, and you're not going to give her any credit for it. Second thing is that on one of those interviews with the whole Amway Quick Start thing,
sure.
I actually had a boss that tried to get me into the Quick Start thing through the Michigan-based team.
Right.
You know, he's all like, you know, I'm going to be rich in 18 months. Well, 18 months later, I have his job, and he's struggling for money.
Well, I'll tell you, here at WRIF in Detroit, Drew and Mike, our morning show, I was listening to them, I don't know, a week and a half or two ago, and they had I can't even remember the man's name, maybe one of you can remind me, but that had been one of the successful people with Amway, which is essentially this pyramid that also you know, sells a few products. And they spent a long time in themselves talking about the financial shenanigans of Amway. And then all these listeners, WRF listeners, got on the air and started bad-mouthing it. Next day, up rolls this convoy of Cadillac SUVs, and in it is Dick DeVos saying, I want to answer everything that you said. So they had him on, I think, for quite a while. And although, this guy knows the ins and outs of it. I mean, I know the surface of it. So, I mean, I wouldn't do real well in a debate with Dick DeVos about Amway. I mean, he'd probably say it's not a pyramid scheme, and that's slandering the good people, and I don't know if I'd be able to go beyond that. I know people that have studied it greatly would give him more than a run for his money. But the point being, I just talked to Mike Clark from Drew and Mike, and I said, did he convince you? He said he skirted a lot of issues. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call, Danielle. Here is Al's in Inkster. Al, hi, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, when it comes to Dick DeVos bringing work into the state, you just have to remember what his wife said when she was head of the Michigan Republican Party under John Engler.
What's that?
Who in his last year lost 150,000 jobs.
Right.
She said Michigan workers just have to face the fact that you are way overpaid.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And so when they sent their jobs overseas, it was because people were demanding a, what did we used to call it? A living wage.
Living wage.
Yeah, what a, What a concept. You're not being competitive because you want to work at a living, you want to work for a living wage.
I want to work for a living wage because I went to college in the 80s, and most of the people that went to college with me were the sons and daughters of blue-collar workers that had good union jobs, you know, UAW or Teamster.
Yeah.
You know, or their parents could afford to send them to school and give them a shot at a better life.
Well, thank you, Al. I appreciate your comments. You know, let me do this and educate me one way or another. Like I said, the phones just lit up with people that had experiences with Amway and Quick Start. I'm not even quite sure what that's all about. Almost all the calls that I heard on Drew and Mike were negative. But some people probably did all right. It sounds like a pyramid scheme to me where you essentially get people working for you and you tell me what it's all about, if you will. All right. In fact, you can do that if you like while I am taking a break. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We get back, though, before we continue on with that. I'm going to tell you how many Americans believe what Bushko says about 9/11. It's startling. I gotta press a button. Here it is. All right, we'll be right back.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Thank you.
expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away, being mad to myself, jump away.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. This program is as ADD as I am, so you can bring up anything at any time. Although I did ask for some calls about Dick DeVos's Amway deal, and is it a scam? Is it real? Most of those things where you got to get other people to work for you always make me a little shaky. DeVos defends it as a way for people to make a lot of money. I did say, though, just before we go back to our phones, and I see some of you want to talk about that, I never realized the extent to which Bushco is distrusted by so many people, and particularly around a signal event in our recent history, that is 9/11. It says, adults in the United States believe the current federal government has not been completely forthcoming on the issue of 9/11 terrorist attacks, according to a poll by the New York Times and CBS News. Well, gee, 53% of us think the Bush administration is hiding something. Oh. And 28% believe it is lying. So almost 5% less than a third of the American people think that the government is completely lying. So that's tens of millions of people that believe, for instance, as it goes, that 9/11 was an inside job. That's how deep. Well, that's what happens when you seize power, as Bushco did in 2000, being the minority candidate. He lost the election by the popular vote, at least, and that's indisputable. I would say, of course, that he also lost it in Florida. According to this article, only 16% of respondents say the government headed by U.S. President George W. Bush is telling the truth on what it knew prior to the terrorist attacks. Well, on May 17th, 2002, here's what Bush said. American people know this about me and my national security team, my administration. I know that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning. I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people. So if he would have known what was ahead, he would have done something, right? Well, on August 6, 2001, while he was down on the ranch clearing brush, he was handed a presidential daily briefing titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., and it mentioned, quote, patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. Well, case closed. All right, let's go back to our phones. If you have something to say about Amway or Quick Start, and you'll have to tell me what that's all about, please do. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Nick. Nick's in Port Huron. Nick, so what is Quick Start?
Actually, it's a very decent business. I mean, basically, like, if you were to go anywhere and buy a product, you just buy it online and you get it shipped to your house. I mean, yes, you can make money on it. I mean, there's really no downside to this business. I mean, it's approved by the Better Business Bureau. I mean, I don't know how much better you can get. A lot of people do lose money on it. I mean, it's a tax write-off. I mean, you really can't go wrong with it. Basically, you would go to a place, buy, say, Craftsman Tool, for instance. You can go buy Craftsman Tools, get them shipped to your house, and you can get a check from it because you don't, they don't have to ship it to a warehouse. They don't have to pay for advertisement. You know where to buy it, and they ship it to you.
Wait a minute. This is not Amway products. This is like Craftsman, Sears-based tools you get? Quickstar?
The base company is Quickstar.
Yeah.
You sign up, you go through Quickstar, and there are other products other than what Quickstar has. There are partner stores. Like, for example, Walt Disney is a partner store.
Oh, this is Quickstar, not Quickstart. It's Quickstar. All right. I mean, I'm Quickstar. Pretty ignorant of all this. And is this an Amway company?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
Sir.
All right. Go ahead.
So basically, they do have Fortune 500 companies like Bass Pro Shops, Craftsman Tools, like Avis.com.
All right. So how do you then sell this stuff?
You don't basically sell it. What you basically do is you basically sign up. There's a small fee for signing up.
Yeah.
You become an independent business owner. So by the government, you own your own business, and you refer people to a website. It's basically like the Walmart of the Internet, and you go to the site, and they pay you to... You get, like, a cutback from the profits that they make from this.
You get, in other words, all right, so you've done this or you're doing it?
Yes, I've been in this for 4 years.
All right, and you're making out all right then?
Yes, I'm doing pretty decent.
Okay, so...
Not bad at all.
Say I wanted a Craftsman, ratchet wrench set. So I want to get it from Nick from Port Huron. How do I do it? How do you get to me? How do you advertise, or how do you?
Well, that's the thing. They don't advertise. The way we advertise is word of mouth.
Uh huh.
Like it's like a movie. You go to a movie. If it's a good movie, you tell your friends.
Right. All right. So I want to get this wrench set. So I go to a website that has like something that's coded to you, and then when I buy it, you get a percentage.
Correct.
Hmm.
It'd be like. Okay, let me give you an example.
Sure.
Okay, say you go to Kmart and you buy what you need to buy.
Right.
Because it's close to you and it's convenient. Okay, next week there's construction, so that's in the way. So next week you go to, say, Meijer's down the road. You know, it's out of your way. It's inconvenient.
So, all right, so you go online to get it.
Yes, you go out of your way and they say, okay, thank you for shopping. We'll give you $20 off your $300 bill. Okay, next week, and if you bring a friend, we'll give you the same $20 back, and give your friend $30.
Well, how does Amway make any money off this?
Because they don't advertise at all. They don't advertise. And
well, I mean, wait, how does cash get in their pocket? If you're getting tools from Craftsman and you're selling them and getting a commission, where does Amway come into this?
They're like, okay, they cut the middleman out, but yet Quickstar is still the middleman. So they don't advertise. They don't have to ship to warehouses. They don't have to pay all the people at the cashiers.
All right. So it's worked well for you. All right. Thank you for that quick start of Quickstar. Appreciate it. All right. Let's go to Marvin. Marvin's in Detroit. Marvin, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, Peter. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me. Well, I just wanted to say that I've been involved in network marketing for a while, and Amway was my first company that I ever got involved with. And it kind of it taught me about network marketing, and I love the industry because it's an industry where the average person, if they have the right company, the right product, and the right infrastructure, can really make some serious income. And a lot of people have a misconception about network marketing, you know. And the thing about it is that you're sponsoring people, true enough, but you're getting commissions from the company. Based on what you do, you know, and what your team does, you know, and you want the company to make money, But the thing about it is as you build your business, as you build your team, okay, you're making commissions from the company.
Yeah.
I was involved in Amway for 3 years. It was way before they went with, you know, they changed over to Quickstar. But it just taught me how network marketing works. And I've been doing network marketing for over 10 years, and I love it.
All right, actually, the connection is so bad, and there's so much noise. I'm going to have to just let it go with that. Thank you for that. It makes it a little clearer. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. This is on another subject, but we can do it. It's James in Lake Orion. James, hi. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Yes, I was going to inform you here that, you know, the Gingellville Community Center, which is located in Lake Orion, Orion Township, after 67 years, was made to start paying property taxes. This has been a nonprofit organization. I mean, it's a 501c, tax exempt, and it served well for all the years, and now they're made to pay taxes. And this went before the tribunal. They spent all their money that they had, the operating costs, to fight this thing, and of course it wiped them out. Now they will have to close this.
Well, that's a shame.
It's December, right. After 67 years, they're going to close the doors.
Well, if you think about it, too, James, here, wealthiest country in the world, suddenly we're hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. We're spending upwards from $300 billion to $500 trillion on Bush's wars. And we can't keep a local community center open. All right. Thank you for it. I appreciate that. Hopefully people in Lake Orion will be addressing that. Here, here's John and Taylor. John, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yes. I would just like to touch on a point that you brought up in the beginning of the show.
Sure.
When you mentioned that Bush was a conservative. Well, I myself am a strong conservative. I don't believe in abortion. I don't believe in gay marriage or any of that. But I also don't believe in Bush. I don't believe that the government has a right or should at any point tell the people what they can and can't do. Whether or not you're a conservative or not, or whether or not you choose to be a Christian or not, is your own damn business. But it has nothing to do with the government.
Sure. Yeah. Well.
And I'd also like to say that, to me, the government only should have two purposes: to promote international trade and to protect the borders. And it just seems like Bush isn't doing either one.
Well, I think he's lost a lot of conservative support. I think there's going to be some big changes. Thank you, John. Here is Karen, and Karen is in Shelby Township. Karen, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us. Well, let me tell people just, though, that they can also call in as some lines opened up. 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just have two questions about Amway. One is, why did they change their name?
I don't know.
And I think because they had problems with the pyramid thing. And number two, why are we seeing commercials on TV for them now?
Well,
and what a great place it is to work at and all this stuff.
Well, you know why that is, right?
Exactly.
Because
yeah.
They've been getting criticism. Now, we just had Marvin and, I forgot the other person. It was John that was saying that, hey, this worked out fine for him. I didn't entirely understand the way that this Quickstar worked. But when Marvin was talking about the creating these teams, the teams are who provide the money, right? They buy tapes and motivational tapes and stuff like that. And that's where a lot of the income comes from as you go up the pyramid, is my understanding.
Right, right.
But I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, but all of a sudden I'm seeing all these Altor or whatever they're called now, you know, commercials on what a great place it is to work at.
Uh-huh.
They had to change their name. Why'd they change their name?
Well, that is a question I'm going to have to throw out to our audience. Thank you for posing it, Karen. I appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jim in Lake Orion. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
I got ripped off by Quickstar, actually.
How's that?
They charged me a $299 fee to join one of the teams that was out of Oxford. I was told that I had to get people recruited underneath me to make any money. I tried it for 60 and 90 days. I got three people. And out of the 60 and 90 days, out of all the three people, I only made like $22.
I'm not even quite sure. This is what I you know, feel as a way outsider and someone who's never really looked into this. But all right, so you paid like $300,
right?
And then what were you doing? I mean, you were selling stuff, or what do you mean recruiting people beneath you? Usually, you don't recruit people; you sell stuff.
Right. What it is, it's a pyramid. You have to get people underneath you in order for you to make money. You can make money off buying stuff for yourself also. And that's where your profit comes in. They give you a set limit that you had to buy every month. You had to buy, like, toilet paper, detergent, baby diapers, different things. And then they would send you a commission check off of actually whatever you bought. So the more you bought from them, the more money you made.
So you mean if you bought $1,000 worth of stuff, they'd send you a check for $100?
Maybe not even that. I spent more than that. I bought TVs. I bought DVD players.
Well, how are you supposed to sell them?
You buy them to yourself, and then what it is, you get people underneath you. So if somebody else pays $299 to join, you get the commission off them. Okay, and then whenever they buy a certain amount of stuff, you get 5 or 10% or whatever that is off them also.
Well, you know, I do know that that there are people that have made an extraordinary amount of money off of this. But what the question is, are there more Jims or more Marvins?
I've talked to a lot of people. I've had my sister was doing it. Everybody that I've known that have done it has always said that it was no good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see everybody doing it. My wife's uncle did it for a year, and he lost a lot of money.
Boy. And,
so, and it's... They're basically like leaning you into it, and then without telling you the full thing, and then if you pay the $299, you're hooked.
Now, Jimmy, I haven't seen these in years. Aren't there Amway products? I mean, that have like the Amway. Is that one of the things you sell? Are they like making toilet paper or soaps or something like this?
They had. I bought my dish soap to them, paper towels, laundry detergent.
I mean, just
diapers,
the stuff, just the
everything.
Stuff you needed in your daily life.
Yeah.
Not quantities for resale.
Right. Yeah.
But the one, and I'm forgetting his name completely. He was saying he was buying like Craftsman tools for resale.
They have them in there. They have Craftsman tools. They have washer and dryers. They have a lot of stuff. It's like a magazine, like an old JCPenney magazine.
Okay.
That they send you, and it's like 100 and some pages thick, and you order the stuff out of there.
Wow. I don't know. I guess I'm used to just going to work and getting a paycheck. This sounds... there are people that have such extraordinary drive that that they can make this happen. But I just wonder the average person that doesn't have this magnetic personality that can suck people into something, how they're going to do. And that if you have something that's only workable for some top echelon, well... That doesn't work out too well. All right. Well, thanks for your story. I certainly appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And here's Brian. Brian's in Lincoln Park. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Yeah. How you doing?
Good.
I was just calling because I was just inside Wayne County Jail because of a child support issue. And there's people that they're sleeping inside of gyms. Which are not, they don't have any bunks, they don't have any place to sleep. What they do is they lay down a plastic thing that looks like a sled that you would slide down a hill in.
Uh-huh.
And they consider that a bed. And it's completely illegal, but they do it.
I mean, this is because you failed to make all your child support payments.
Correct.
Okay.
You failed to make all your payments. You paid, but you did not meet the requirements.
Yeah.
All right. And I completely agree with the fact that you have to make your payments, but why should people have to deal with that? You shouldn't have to deal with that.
Well, yeah, I thought it was just as bad. You know, what they're doing is they won't issue hunting licenses.
That's something else there. Yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable the way you have to do this. I mean... There's people, there's lawyers, there's regular people that they come inside the system, and once you're in the system, it doesn't matter. You're sitting there on concrete floors, and they don't give you a blanket, they don't give you a pillow, and that's where you are.
You know, this is incredible. As long as I've been doing talk radio, that what a constant in all of this is just what a horrid system all this child support is. Now, as you said, there are some men who just aren't meeting their obligations. What do they call them after a while? Deadbeat dads. Some of the deadbeat dads have been screwed so badly by the system, and some things, their deal goes down. They are even, it's worsened by their inability to make the payments. And I guess what happens is you're held in contempt of court because there's no debtor's prison. Like, if I can't afford to pay my debts, can't be like in England the way it used to be, can't put me in jail. But for this, for failing to make a court-ordered payment, they can put you in the slammer. Doesn't make a bit of sense. I got to take a break. Thanks. Hey, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and we'll be right back.
WRIF.com. We'll pay. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. If you're elsewhere in the universe, you can do the math when this will appear. In about an hour, it will air, I should say, not appear. Going to be interviewing, who am I doing first? I guess Larry Tai. He's written a book along with Kitty Dukakis, who's the wife of the 1988 Democratic Party candidate for president. And she undergoes electric convulsive shock therapy. So you say, whoa, man, this is pretty crazy stuff. This is an incredible interview. I mean, electroshock therapy, didn't you always think that was the absolute worst thing imaginable? Well, this is a real reexamination of all this. And then following that, Jeff Faux, F-A-U-X, he's the founder of the Economic Policy Institute, EPI.org. He's going to be talking about globalization and the impact it has rather than Governor Granholm creating a bad job situation in Michigan. You'll see the role of globalization. And also Jeff Faux is going to be in town tonight, Monday night, and talk about the same topic. You go to my website and go to the calendar for details. Peter Werby, it's going to be down at Wayne State University. PeterWerby.com, W-E-R-B-E. Also, Barbara Ehrenreich, the woman who wrote the book Nickel and Dimed about how it is to be working poor in this country, she's going to be at the library, the downtown main library, I think it's 7 o'clock. I might check that out. Okay. Oh, yeah. Steve sends this into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It's an article that's called Why Hasn't Bush Signed the Military Commissions Act? This is the torture act that people like the Republicans and a few Democrats like Debbie Stabenow voted for. And this could be an October surprise. One of them, we're into October, a few weeks away from the election. The Republicans doing terribly, as well they should. And this bill that Bush said was necessary to try all these malefactors that were in such in danger from and be able to torture them and not have access to courts and essentially overturn about 800 years of English-American law, judicial law. And why hasn't he signed it yet? Because he's going to sign it about a week before the elections. So he'll look like he's tough on terror. Bree writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, Dick DeVos is not a businessman. He's a corporate executive. World of difference. From what I have seen of the second debate, he had this look about him like he couldn't wait to start punishing people. Now, these right-wingers are punishing. That's one of their big traits. If you're just joining us and you're not here in Michigan, we're talking about a Republican challenger, extreme far-right winger, with a history of funding with his tens of millions of dollars. I mean, a business major. Oh, he's a successful businessman. He got it from his dad. Another one of these guys. He was born on third base and thinks he hit a triple, right? And he's running against the incumbent governor, Jennifer Granholm, that was faced with a terrible economy left to her by the last Republican governor, John Engler, who lost, as one of our callers said, 150,000 jobs. Oh, we're also talking about this Amway business called Quickstar, which I thought was Quick Start. Turns out it's Quickstar, Quixtar.com. And on this website, wait a minute, I've already got this up here, don't I? Let's see, where is it? All right. Land of Hope, the Land of Opportunity, the Land of Will, Quickstar. And it's all over the world. English, Estados Unidos, Espanol, Canada, I guess it's just those three countries. And it says, embraced by hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs seeking a web-based business of their own. So a couple of people called in to 313-298-WRIF to say it was a good deal. A number of other people have said that it sucks. So let me hear from you. Here is John in Ann Arbor. John, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for coming on the air. What's your story?
Hey, Peter. Can I tell you my little story about pyramid scam I joined a few years ago?
Sure.
Well, I was 19, and one of my best buddies, who's like, you know, we were always looking for business opportunities. You know, we were young and just looking for stuff, and he's like, oh, I got this offer from my friend who went to this university in Chicago, and it's called Truck Alliance. And, you know, you basically do the same type of stuff as we were talking about, as you were talking about. You get a magazine of supplies, and you basically have to sell them to people. And the whole point is to get them to buy it every month, which is why you'll often hear the phrase, making money while you sleep.
Yeah.
They throw that phrase around a lot. And so, you know, the point is that you get all these products, shampoos and stuff like that, and like the other caller said, you basically get a 30% discount. But what they lie to you and tell you is that they're superior products made by all these high-up people from companies like Paul Mitchell or whatever else, and they claim they're superior and they sell them for really high prices, and then they claim their prices are lower, but in reality they're not. But I got sucked in. I bought the starter kit, bought a few things, and it was humiliating going to people's houses and trying to sell them stuff that they didn't want.
So you were essentially doing sales, though, like door-to-door, hey, buy this shampoo.
Well, to be honest, I was 19. I had a decent group of friends, and, you know, I'd go to relatives and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was kind of like door-to-door, but more like people I already knew.
But weren't you the whole idea you're supposed to get a team that below
you? Right. I was part of a team. My friend had joined the team and was trying to recruit me into the team. And basically, I mean, it's crazy. There's 17 different levels of payment, you know, 17 different spikes on the pyramid. And it's basically the amount of dollars your team raises allows you to go up in levels. Nobody ever climbs to the top, ever, or anywhere near it.
I mean, a few, you know, there's got to be a few success stories. So
I think basically what happens, though, is the people... What I did, what I found out when I got out of it, is I researched it. I'm like, you know what, I should have researched this at first. I'm going to do it now. They were being sued in over 30 states. They had to change their name. They used to be Equinox. Then they were Truck Alliance. This is all related to the Quickstar stuff. You have some of the same CEOs and people in charge. And there's just tons of lawyers groups out there who are trying to get pyramid scams outlawed, but they always sneak around the law in various ways. And, you know, the people who are rich are the ones that started it.
Yeah. I mean, we see that Mr. Amway Sr., Mr. DeVos Sr. is worth like, what was it? What did I say earlier? Like $3.5 billion. Well, John, thanks for your story. I appreciate it very much. 19 and looking for business opportunities. When I was 19, I was looking for like two things. Neither of I necessarily say on the air. Here's Charles in Waterford. Charles, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Oh, not a lot. Just listening to your show, obviously, and had a couple things to say about Quickstar. So,
sure.
First, let me say I do agree with both sides. But first and foremost, let me say that Quickstar is nothing more than just a website, and as far as it goes, there's a lot of good things that can happen in joining Quickstar and a lot of bad things. It depends on really what kind of team you're with. Some teams, you know, do scams and things like that and try to sell things and try to make their money that way. Other teams don't focus on the selling and do, you know, you do points and put volume online. That's how you get paid. And if you don't put in your points, you're not going to get paid.
What about all the stuff like motivational tapes and all that? What's up with that?
It's testimonials on people that have been successful in the business and continue to be successful. Try to help motivate you and get you to, you know, stay positive and keep chugging along, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And you're expected to buy them? And your team's expected to buy them?
You're not expected to do anything. It's you don't have to do anything you don't want to do, anything you don't want to commit yourself to. It's just a learning tool, a teaching tool. It helps you learn how to keep your business successful and keep, you know. And no successful business or big business is just going to be as simple as telling you a couple things and having you go on your way. You have to continuously do things to make your business better and build the business bigger and keep the growth.
How have you done in it?
Right now I'm doing awesome. My team's doing great. I put in my 100 points, and I get my checks every week, or every month, I mean, every month.
Yeah, all right, well, success story. Thank you, Charles. All right. Let's see here. Well, there's a couple themes as well, so we'll, let's go back to another one. Here's Shay in Ferndale. Shay, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
Good. Yes, actually, I stepped out of the car when I was listening to you talk about politics. I want to talk to you about that, too. But then when I jumped back in, I heard you talking about, deadbeat dads.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, believe me, I could talk to you about hours about either. But anyways, sticking with the deadbeat dads, my parents split up when I was a kid. And by the way, sorry if I'm sounding a little froggy. I'm fighting the flu here, listening to you.
Okay, go ahead.
Back in the day, it was fun to court, but it's still kind of the same thing now. When I grew up, if you were a female and had a child, you got the child because it's like everybody thought that
right.
Mother's the best parent, blah blah blah. And you know, I'm here to tell you, I'm living testimony. That's not the case. My mom, I don't want to get Oprah here, but it was, you know, she wasn't the best person in the world. My dad was always there for me, loving the whole nine yards. But the system is so screwed up where if my mom had a problem with my dad, she'd just call up and say, you know, whatever, like she wasn't receiving her payments or I'm coming back bruised or beaten or something like that. But she'd always do it on, like, a Friday when I'm supposed to go see him. Next thing you know, my dad's going to jail.
Well, the payments, of course, were paid to the court, which then were transferred to the mother. It wasn't a direct deal. But, I mean, one of the things, of course, that happened, Shay, is, I don't mean your situation, but in general, is that the child support payments would be extraordinarily large and really hard on the father. And then the mother would take up with someone like a boyfriend who had lots of money. The guy loses his house, loses his kids. I mean, a lot of it has been an extraordinary nightmare. And there never seems to be, of course, you know, then when, and I mean, if all I wanted to talk about was how bad the child support system was, we could probably do this for the next 5 hours. But then women start weighing in and start talking about how bad the dads are and how they don't pay and they've been abusive. It's just such a horrible situation. I have no idea. I don't even know if I've ever even heard of anybody come up with a solution. Mostly, people have individual cases, such as you're talking about, that just are just sad and tragic, and everyone gets hurt within it. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's go back to Amway and back to Ann Arbor. Dave, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good. What's up?
I just have a couple comments. My parents got wrapped up into Amway years ago when I was a kid, and like they will they'll advertise it as not a pyramid scheme but like an octopus scheme, because you can never, in a pyramid scheme, you can never become richer than the person above you. But they always tell you that, you know, you go to see these motivational speakers like one of the gentlemen spoke about before, that try to give you hope, and this is how I worked it through the system, and you can make more money than me, you just got to keep going out there. And they want you to exact, like, you know, network, and you buy the products that you're going to use for a discounted price, and you sell them to other people for a slightly inflated price, and you make commission off that, plus, you know, a little bit more. And then the way the company makes money off it is, you know, they're selling you your products for what they consider a discounted price, but they're getting them for cheaper anyway, so they're still cutting it off the top. And then the ways that they're big advertising and is they started, instead of just selling like Amway products like soap and shampoo and whatnot, is they started cutting deals with bigger companies and bigger firms like Sony and Panasonic. So now, instead of being able to just order soap and food and whatnot, you can order a TV. You could order a car through Ford or GM and sell it that way. And, you know, so and I'm going to assume, I mean, knowing my parents, I've seen the Quickstar boot up on their computer, so I can imagine that, you know, they got ran into that. So it's probably, you know, runs along the same kind of aspect, instead of having to carry around a pamphlet and a book to show friends and family, you know, you can just send them to a website, or you can build a website and link it up. So now all you have to do is just maintain your website and sell stuff over the internet for a discounted price.
It all sort of makes my head swim, to tell you the truth.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've watched my my old man, like, go around and, you know, his, you know, one of the first things that they were telling him when he was doing this is, like, you need to network. You need to network. Go out and sell yourself. If, and what they were pressing, the kind of program they were pressing on him, you know, because I come from a huge family, is, you know, buy all the products that you're going to use for the next 6 months. Like, buy 18 cases of toilet paper because you know you're going to use it. And you're going to save money on it, and we're going to cut your commission check. But if you can get 8 people to do that and then 8 more people to do that and build this octopus web underneath you, eventually you won't have to work anymore because the commission that rolls in from the bottom is going to pay you to live.
Wow.
And so that's, yeah, and it, you know, so like they, you know, they try to get people to, you know, buy what you're going to use and buy our products, which, you know, they claim to be decent and well. You know, I still see some of the products in my parents' house to this day. And, you know, my parents are frugal people, so, you know, maybe they work well, maybe they're getting a cheaper price on it, but it's not as much as what it was in the past when they first started off. But, so, yeah, they want, you know, and that was the whole thing. Now you don't have to be a salesman for Amway and go out and sell stuff. You can just, you know, sell yourself and tell people to save money by buying our products.
Well, yeah, to make money while you sleep, as someone said. Now, on the face of it, it would seem, however intricate and cockamamie it seems to me, if there are people that are involved in these setup that brings products to people at cheaper prices, no matter how involved it is, you would think, what's the problem? Maybe they're, I mean, small businesses overwhelmingly fail. I mean, the majority of small businesses that start up fail. So that on the that doesn't seem unusual that people that get involved in this wouldn't, you know, every one of them be successful. You know, sort of the propaganda is, but. It's not going to happen if you started a Coney Island or a shoe repair store either. Most of them go out of business. So, it on the face of it would seem okay. And then up at the top, of course, the most successful entrepreneurs are the DeVos family that have parlayed this into billions. All right, thanks for your little part in it. I was going to kind of cut this off, but it looks like that's almost everything that people want to talk about. But let's do Richard from Macomb, who wants to talk about child support, and then we'll get back to the Amway stuff. Hey, Richard, welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
Thank you for letting me talk.
Sure.
I would like to talk about the child support system in Macomb County specifically.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was divorced in 2000. And I was trying to get a hearing. I wanted half of the physical custody of my daughter. My ex-wife, who, you know, she's okay. She's, I think, a good mother, wanted full custody. And we proceeded to enter into the system and go ahead and we were setting up for a trial under the judge, Anthony Viviano. Now, Anthony Viviano was originally a probate judge, and he was appointed to circuit court judge by Engler.
All right, but give me a little bit more just the headlines of this, because most of these things are pretty involved, so give me the broad outlines of it, if you would.
Okay. We went through the system, and during that system, the judge, Viviano, circumvented the process and denied me basically a hearing. As a result of this, I have not been able to see nor talk to my daughter. I have been jailed several times. At the current moment, I have a felony warrant for child support out. And it's not that I can't pay, it's that I'm refusing to pay because I'm not even allowed to talk to my daughter over the phone. I can't get an attorney. I've actually talked to Michael Cox's.
Well, why can't you get an attorney? I hear ads on WRIF for attorneys that handle this very thing, or is it a financial burden that you can't meet?
Oh, we don't even get to the financial part. I start telling the attorneys all the ins and outs of my case, and they say, you know what, I just can't help you. In fact, I called.
You know, you're on your cell phone, and it's not giving us a good enough signal. Well, as I said earlier, Richard, I'm sure that we could spend, and I don't mean to diminish the fact this exemplifies the problem. If there are so many horror stories, of which you have one, and I'm sure there's probably 150 others out there. You're right. There's something wrong with the system. This is it is endless, and I don't know why there has never been a way to fix this, because there are too many victims. There's too many dads, too many kids, too many moms that wind up just getting screwed by this system. I don't know if it has to do just with the fact that it's a split in a family and you're trying to make financial arrangements or what, but something ought to be done. All right, thank you. I appreciate your call. Let's see here. Here is Marie. Marie is in Warren. Hi, Marie. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I love your show. I try to listen to it every time I can, but I wanted to, my husband's experience in Amway, he spent like $300 in those self-help tapes that they pretty much forced you into buying. He had missed one of the monthly meetings that was in his sponsor had called him on the phone. We were sitting in a restaurant and started screaming at him that he missed the meeting.
Wow.
Then I got mad at that point and got on the phone with the sponsor and told him, guess what, my husband has just quit this. So they would use so much psychological warfare on him while he was in that program. Like they were pressuring him to get friends and family involved, and they weren't hearing the answers they wanted to hear. They would start copying an attitude with him.
Well, Marie, that's what I heard on the Drew and Mike show when they began talking about this, that people, I haven't heard that much of it here, but what people were saying there, that it had a lot of aspects like a cult, pressure
right.
on people to bring
in. Yeah, that's what I told my husband when he first joined him. I said, they're a bunch of Moonies. You better be careful with them.
Well, the idea is, and people are talking about families splitting up, I'll tell you, this was nothing to do with Amway. But there was one of these telephone pyramid schemes about selling. This was about 10 years ago when cell phones weren't real big. And in this something I was taking part of, this guy started trying to get everyone to take his phone service. Now, we were at the time taking something called Working Assets that turns over parts of its profit to the peace and social justice movements. I wasn't about to move off of that. And this guy virtually stopped talking to me.
Yeah, when his sponsor started, and I'm sitting across from him in the restaurant, I'm hearing this man scream at my husband because he missed a meeting down in Ohio. I said, oh, no, we're done. But I have to say one thing, that those motivational tapes, it motivated him right out of Amway and into his own electronics business. So that worked out.
Well, there you go, Marie. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF, and here's Trent. Trent's in Linden. Hi, Trent. You're on the air.
How's it going?
Going good. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
All right, I just wanted to fill you in on how I got recruited for a little meeting.
Sure.
That turned me off. All right, one day I was working, I was doing delivery up in Saginaw, which is about 45 minutes from where I live. And I met some guy, it was his mother-in-law's house, and he was telling me how he was 24 years old and retired and had all this money and whatnot, never really got to the point. He gave me his number. It was going through my head, all the good stuff he was talking about, but didn't even really think about it. And one day, all of a sudden, he called me. I guess I had exchanged numbers with him, too. And he said he was in the area where I lived, and I thought that was kind of weird. And he was asking me to put on some nice clothes and meet him. And so I did, just to go up with him, because he didn't seem like a threatening guy or anything.
Uh-huh.
But we went up to a hall up in Saginaw, and we got in there, and it seemed like they had security at the door or something. They were checking people, and he had to give them his credentials to get in. And once we got in there, everybody was drinking this exact same energy drink that I hadn't ever seen before, and it was, like, very cult-like. He was making us listen to self-help tapes, and he was listening to himself the whole time on the way there, like, in the background while he was talking to me about all the fortunes he was going to make and stuff. And I got there, and it seemed like kind of a joke. I saw it as like a joke, the way that they were just trying to like tell me all the great stuff that was going to happen and show me all these great cars on the screen that all the people had earned from being on there.
Did you ever join?
No, I didn't join. I went that one time and he gave me some CDs and stuff, and I didn't want to tell him to his face because everybody took it so seriously. I didn't want to upset him because I heard of people like this going, like that lady before me said, yelling at him and stuff.
Well, in those systems like that, they desperately need to recruit people to the teams. I mean, ultimately, the more people you get in your team, the more money you make. So it's not just, oh, I don't know. I mean, it's of key importance. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here is Kevin. Kevin's in Howell. Kevin, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRF, and so are you. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Love the show.
Thank you.
Hey, I had a couple of comments about that Quickstar. My wife and I had just joined it this last year, and a couple of bizarre things happened. When I went to one of the meetings, I wanted to have a little bit of moral support from them. And my way of moral support is I want to see somebody that's made some money. Well, nobody could tell me, you know, how much they've made. They all want to support it, you know, and build this product up, but nobody can say how much they're making or show me a paycheck or, but they just keep on hamming it up that, you know, they're making this money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just keep pushing that towards you. The other comment is that all these pyramid scams, I don't understand why they all only charged like $300. It's always between $200 and $300.
I mean,
have you noticed that?
No. In fact, I know so little about it. I don't. That that's why this is all extraordinarily interesting to me. Like I said, I'm inherently suspicious of it, and it's it may be the kind of thing, you know, in a pyramid, the higher up you are towards the point of it, the more money you make, the lower you are on the base. And I guess probably the answer would be, well, those people on the base just have to recruit more people under them. I don't know. So, I mean, one of the things you have to think about is that that our wages very frequently are not sufficient to meet the kind of middle class lifestyle that we either used to have or thought that we were going to have as the whole economy for a lot of the middle class and the working class goes south, literally in many cases. And people see this as a possible supplement to income and the possibility of economic security. So it must have a great appeal in many ways, eh?
Definitely. I mean, for a couple hundred bucks, they promise you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, it sounds like. But nobody has produced a paycheck to me, though. You know, they all talk and say that they're making all this money, but I have yet. I mean,
well,
the meetings and all the seminars and the pep talks, but it just, nobody's produced.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. One more call, then we'll go to a break. It's Frank in Walled Lake. Frank, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, you mentioned earlier about so many people in the United States don't believe what happened on 9/11, what we're told is true.
Right.
Are you familiar why they think that?
Well,
I mean, all the conspiracy theories and things.
Well, yeah, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, there's DVDs out that
right.
If you go to loosechange911.com.
Right, sure.
They've got a DVD on there that shows frame-by-frame analysis of a lot of the attacks. And if people want to go look at it, that's why people think that way. There's a lot of evidence out there that points to something different happening that day.
Well, you can go to my site, Frank, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. Over on the left, there's a headline from the New York Daily News that says, Bush knew. It's very weird. It's not. It's a real headline. And, of course, Bush was told in advance, as I said, on, August 5th, 2001, that bin Laden was planning an attack just like the one he carried out. And, of course, they sat there and did nothing. And the links to it, I mean, I'll tell you, I've seen the Loose Change video, and I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's that convincing. Someone said, what really happened? I'm not sure. But I doubt if there was a explosives placed in the building. I mean, you start to talk about a conspiracy that involves too many people, too much logistics, too much technology. Those are the kind of conspiracies that get exposed. And people say they are exposed because here's the evidence. But if you started to have people in it that were up in the dozens or the 20s or the hundreds, you get someone's going to break. He's going to know about it. Here's what I think happened. I think that Bush Co. came in there, and they had plans that the next time there was any attack on any American asset anywhere in the world, including the United States, that they were going to invade Afghanistan and they were going to do, and they were as soon as they could invade Iraq. This was all planned in advance. They got warnings. They did absolutely nothing. I suspect that they were as shocked as the rest of us when the magnitude of the attack came. And I think it was fortuitous, just plain luck that they were able to drop those buildings. And I know the whole thing about the faster than gravity, controlled demolition, or whatever all that stuff is. But, you know, there was a debate on television with people from Popular Mechanics that that people that saw it said that they refuted every single one of those controlled explosion theories. Well, I know that's something you're thinking about. I'll think about it, too. I'm always open for more information. I do believe that Bushko is capable of anything, and it's going to be interesting to see what they do in the next few weeks. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, so our final segment, then we're going to do a couple interviews. Actually, it's not we at all. It is me. And we're going to be talking about electroshock therapy. That's going to be quite a buzz. And also talk about globalization. A couple of good interviews. Stay tuned for that. All right, let's see what we're going to do next here. Here's Lindsay. Lindsay's in Ypsilanti. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter. So nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Lindsay. What's up?
I had to stay late to work today, and this is the only bonus that I get to hear your show.
Okay.
I just have an interesting story about child support.
Sure.
I kind of caught on in the tail end of the conversation, but my parents got divorced when I was, I don't know, first grade, kindergarten, something like that, pretty much my whole life. But I lived with my mom when I was younger until I was probably 13. And she went to jail for shoplifting. She had quite a few drug habits. And I pretty much raised my, I started staying home with my brothers and sisters when I was in first or second grade and lived in this environment. And it was just normal to me. That's kind of what I grew up in. When I moved in with my dad when I was in sixth grade, of course, which is awesome for a teenage girl, mind you, too.
Mm-hmm.
With your father when you're about to turn into a teenager and all that. But since my mom was in jail, my dad never asked for child support ever. And even through now, if he would have ever asked or, he went through front of the court to get it taken away, because if he would have ever asked for it, first of all, he would have never gotten it. Second of all, she would still be in jail to this day, I'm sure. And the weird thing about it is when we were younger, my mom used to hold it over his head to get paid in cash when he picked us up every weekend to take it to the weekend.
Yeah.
And it was just it's just such a weird situation to think about now. But that was a totally normal situation to me, and it's so weird that that can happen in the United States to me.
Well, it is, and it's like I've said to a couple other callers. So you think about your situation and then think that you're not the only person in the state or in the country that's suffering.
For sure.
So that means then we have a system that sure ain't working, right?
Yeah, it's not serving its purpose.
Yeah.
Very well, anyway.
All right. Thank you, Lindsay. Appreciate you joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Scott. Scott's in Waterford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing good.
I feel like I called your show actually a couple times, and I just had a couple comments. First, about the Amway thing, I think it comes back to it sort of seems like if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
There you go.
So, these people are all paying the $300 up front. Where's that all going? That's probably going right to the top of the pyramid. So it might seem like a scam to them, but if you're at the top of the pyramid, it probably doesn't seem like a scam at all.
Right.
So, and then my other comment is this morning I caught the replay of one of the debates between Jennifer Granholm and DeVos.
Right.
And I'm being a younger adult, I wonder if it's almost time for there to be a third party introduced to the system, because it doesn't seem like we have candidates that really care about the state. They just constantly go after each other and go after each other rather than trying to fix what goes wrong with the economy here.
Well, there is a third party. There's the Green Party.
But it doesn't seem, whenever something comes up, it's always, Democrat versus Republican, and if anything else is there, it just sort of, doesn't get the due say that it should.
Well, I was telling people this weekend that I was not going to vote for Debbie Stabenow. Here's a Democrat, and she's supposed to be a very liberal Democrat. She voted against the war resolution. She knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in the war resolution in 2002. And Bush says he attains all these powers from jailing people all over the world, torture, all this stuff. Suspending habeas corpus. And yet, in the last few months, she voted for the Bush torture bill, this Military Commissions Act. She voted to build this wall, which is just insane, and supposedly to keep people out from coming in from Mexico. She voted for this flag amendment. She voted for the bankruptcy bill. I said, what is this? It's like voting, we don't want a Republican in there. I said, well, it's like having one in there. So then people say, well, if you want the Democrats to take control of the Senate, you can't let this sheriff from Oakland County beat her. So I'm thinking, this is blackmail. She can vote however she wants, because essentially, I'm sure she doesn't believe in any of it, but figures she does not want to be facing a situation where someone could, you know, an ad could go, Debbie Stabenow voted against the security of the United States, or something like that. Debbie Stabenow voted to allow flag burning. Yeah. So she votes right wing, as hoping that she's not going to have this kind of advertising against her. But gutless, opportunistic voting. So I say, I'm not going to vote for her. I'm going to vote for the Green candidate. And then people say, and I know the guy, David Soul, who is running for her seat on the Green Party. And then everybody starts saying, oh, you know, I know. But so I'm saying it's just blackmail. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Scott. Where are we here in all this? All right, here is Pete. Pete's in Shelby Township. Pete, it's Pete. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, I was with Equinox years ago, and I answered an ad that said, make $10,000 a month. So I kind of got pumped up about it. I was, you know, kind of young and naive. And I went down to talk to this lady, this little seminar, and she said, she showed me all these tapes of these people making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they're all doctors and lawyers, and you can make all this kind of money. And you had to pay $60 for the manual. And then she wanted you to buy these tapes. And then they take you to these seminars, and you got to pay $300 for the weekend. So they're making money off the seminars. And then she said, if you want to be a manager, you got to pay $5,000 for products. So what they do is they call it is garage qualified. So they want you to spend $5,000 in products. So I had a whole closet full of products, and I became a manager. And she said, if you spend a little more money, you can become a supervisor. And if you want to get to the top level, you can become a director. So they're making money on having you go to these seminars and buying all these products. And she's making all the money off of me, and I was making nothing. So I'm glad you have the show. And you're explaining people, you know, they can lose a lot of money in this. So.
Yeah. Well, you got to be, like I said, it's obvious some people make money. And certainly the Voss family has made billions, literally billions, used its tens of millions of dollars to fund far-right wing. They have something called, what is it, the something or other center, the Mackinac Center, that tries to insert right-wing policy statements in newspapers and all that. So they've made a fortune, and then some people have. The question is, and that's, I wonder if there's written material on this to see, have the majority of people done well or the majority of people done poorly? That's interesting. All right, thank you very much. You know what I don't understand? I thought for a while, you know, I've never had real big career aspirations, and I was just too lazy. That's why I never could do, you know, one of these hustle gigs like we're talking about. I've always been pretty lazy and just get along. I don't have kids or anything like that. Never, you know, never wanted fancy cars or watches or clothing or anything like that. I wanted time in my life. So, but a couple times I had nationally syndicated jobs, and I started thinking, geez, what if I, you know, you can make millions in this occupation, in the entertainment industry. So I started thinking, what would I do with it? I mean, what if I made millions? What, I mean, I wonder what, Mr. Big makes. So, like, he's got had a contract for $333 billion. I wouldn't know what the hell to do. I wouldn't want to live in a neighborhood with rich people. Excuse me, some of you are probably living in that neighborhood and are decent people. And I have wealthy, you know, upper-middle-class friends. Do I have any wealthy friends? No. But upper middle class friends, middle class people, and particularly working class people would probably identify the people I'm talking about as rich. But they're not rich. They're upper middle class. And I don't want to live in those areas. But so I started thinking, what if I made millions? What if I made $1 million a year? What would I do with it? And I thought I would be giving a lot of it away to peace and social justice groups, environmental groups. And I actually that was my dream. That, I mean, I wanted to have security for my wife and I. Wanted to have a house maybe a little better than I have now. Not, like I say, not some grand one in some upper class area. But then I thought it would be really cool to go out to the Sea Shepherds and buy them another ship or something like that so they could protect marine life. Wait, what I'm getting to, well, one thing, I'm bragging. I'm saying, gee, what a wonderful man I am. So forget about all that. What I'm really getting at, why when these people become so filthy rich, do they become so greedy and so narrow and try to hurt other people? I mean, why aren't the Waltons, who own Walmart, why are they trying to give everybody $30 an hour and saying, yeah, you should unionize, and yeah, we're having daycare centers here, and we're going to give everybody medical care, and they would still be multi-billionaires. I don't understand it. It's just got to be pathological, just absolutely pathological. All right, let's see. Well, back to our, let me see, where I'll do it this way. All right. It's Brian and Flint. Brian, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, I kind of want to chime in on that Jennifer Granholm, the election candidate. They really want to bring jobs to Michigan. They need to fix the speed limit. I'm a truck driver. I don't do the speed limit in Michigan. It's 55 miles an hour per truck, 70 for cars. It's a hazard. We're a big hazard out here because you got a car flying up on you at 70 miles an hour. You're doing 55 miles an hour. You know, they're going to hit.
What do you think? A truck ought to have the same, 70?
No, it should be at least 65. I mean... They got it raised up to 60. That's a big improvement from 55, but it's still not there. You know what I'm saying?
I do. You know, I was just looking at an article, Brian, that was saying that that in Texas, in this highway, that it's now the speed limit for trucks and cars is 80.
Yep. Yeah, New Mexico's got that same thing.
What, have you ever driven a rig on with that kind of speed?
Oh, yeah. They've got a... strip a highway up into Montana that there is no speed limit on it. You do whatever you feel like.
Oh, man.
You get one of these big trucks rolling at 120 miles an hour, you feel it.
Well, I could imagine. I could imagine some problems with that, but I hear you. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Marty in Windsor. Marty, Peter Werby, thanks for making our show international. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight?
Going great.
I just want to let you know, I went to college a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they made me pay all this money, you know, for my tuition and everything.
Sure.
And then they said I had to buy all these books and so that I would learn. Well, that's the same thing as what they do in Quickstar. And nobody realizes that. It's altogether different in their opinion. Well, it's not. It's the same thing.
Hmm. I don't know. I mean, you got to have textbooks.
Well, it's the same thing as with Quickstar. You know, everyone thinks, well, you got to buy all these tools or, you know. Yeah, you got to learn from somebody.
Well, oh, yeah. You mean, so that's why you have to buy all the motivational tapes and...
Exactly.
And the CDs and...
You ask a computer expert. I guarantee he's going to seminars every year.
Yeah.
I guarantee he's learning every year. It's the same thing with, I have my own motorcycle dealership. Every year I got to go to a big seminar and meet with everybody from my dealership. And then once a month I have to meet with my sales rep. It's the same thing. People just don't realize it.
Well, certainly there has to be, people have to be current in their industry or their trade or their profession. But this still, I don't know, kind of gives me the creeps a little. But thank you, Marty. I'm going to go by a little quickly on people because we're almost out of time here. Here's Chris in Detroit. Chris, hi. Tell us quick.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I want to talk about that Quick Start business. It was like, that was like in 2002. My girlfriend at the time got me into it.
Uh-huh.
So it was like $100 a year, something like that, and the motivational tapes were like, $12 a week.
Wow. Well, what about what Marty said? It's kind of typical of any business, or it's like a college that you got to learn the stuff.
Yeah, that business is good if you're a good salesman. If you're not a good salesman, it's not going to work.
Well, it does strike me that you're right, that some people have that ability to sell everybody, recruit everybody, but it's not for everybody. But maybe too many people wind up to be sort of the cannon fodder for it.
Yeah, I got some people under me to do it, but they joined, but they never bought anything, so that wasn't any good at all.
Wow. No, that's not good. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Jim and Howell. Jim, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Peter, hi. How you doing?
Doing
great
good.
Show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to chime in about Amway. And but let me step back a little bit. Are you familiar with Robert Kiyosaki?
No.
Okay. Robert Kiyosaki is one of the real estate gurus.
Uh-huh.
He sells the motivational tapes and all of the products he can possibly sell. He's done well in real estate, but he actually started out in Amway. And I think one of the things I wanted to make known was that I had gotten involved and bought motivational tapes through him. And it was odd that one of the seminars I went to was like $2,800.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I forked the money out. And the advisor I had, one of the things that she specialized in was neuro-linguistic programming. Excuse me. I'm nursing a cold myself tonight, too.
Okay.
And
Wait, what is neuro what?
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and she was a specialist in it. And as soon as I heard that, I knew exactly what that meant.
What?
The motivational tapes basically, lack of better terms, they brainwash you into buying their product or whatever it is they're peddling, books, tapes, soap, for that matter.
Yeah.
And
Do motivational tapes really work? I can't imagine.
They work because they use select words that stimulate certain parts of your brain to feel good about yourself, about what you're doing. And neuro-linguistic programming, in a sense, is programming your brain by language. So mm-hmm. if you have a motivational speaker like Tony Robbins, or if you've seen one of those crazy things on TV at 4:30 in the morning, you understand that, wow, there might be something here. Well, they're using a sequence of words to go to a center of your brain to allow you to understand what's going on. And your brain is telling you this is a good thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is. It just means they're choosing the right way to get to you.
Well, that makes me a little uneasy, too, because what we essentially want is to be able to have trust be what's between people in the community. And if there's some people that are using language or using pyramid structures or whatever as a way to get over on other people, then we're not a village. We're not a community. We're these, it's this dog-eat-dog situation that's the opposite of human community. Well, all right. Thank you for that. And one quick last call. Randy from Royal Oak. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Real quick, I was calling about stun guns that the police use, the tasers.
Yeah.
Monday morning, my cousin, James Simons, I don't know if you saw it on the news, was murdered by the Lincoln Park police. They stunned him 8 times.
Wow.
I just wanted to get it out here in the public so that they know what to expect. He was in kidney failure and having delusions, and they knew what was going on through the 911 call, and they still continued to stun him when he was on the ground. He couldn't get up. He couldn't even move when they got there.
Well, Randy, I'm out of time, but people should be aware of that. All of these modern little technological gadgets that began with mace and now are into these tasers and all that ought to all be banned. They're used inappropriately so many times, and they were supposed to be a way in which police were safer and also the person they were trying to arrest would be safer. I think in the main that's not been the case, and they've been misused too many times. And I don't know about this case, but I certainly will take a look at it. And my sympathies to you and your family. All right. Stay tuned, folks. We've got a couple of interviews ahead that I think you're going to find real interesting, and we'll talk live next week.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yes.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I don't know if you're anything like me, but when you hear the term electroshock, when people used to be, and remember my verb, the past tense, used to be given electroshock for psychiatric, problems or whatever you'd call it, it scared the hell out of me. A lot of the images I have from it are from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that Jack Nicholson film way back when. And I was absolutely shocked, if you will, to see a book that said maybe we should be reexamining this, and there's a whole new version of electroshock therapy. The book is called Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. It's ECT, and its subtitle is A Journalist's Account of Psychiatry's Most Controversial Treatment and a Moving Portrait of One Woman's Life-Changing Experience. The woman is Kitty Dukakis, who is the wife of the former governor of Massachusetts, who is also the 1988 Democratic Party candidate for president. And the journalist is Larry Tai. Some of you who listen regularly may remember we just aired a repeat broadcast of Larry Tai's Rising from the Rails. Larry is an award-winning journalist. He spent 15 years with the Boston Globe, and his primary beat was medicine. He's also taught journalism at Boston University, Northeastern Tufts and Harvard, and now runs a Boston-based fellowship program for medical journalists. Larry Tai, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be back with you, Peter.
Is that the reaction you get from most people when they usually don't put the C in, they just say electroshock therapy. Man, that's something from the 19th century.
Absolutely the reaction that I get. Most people think it was a tortuous form of treatment that was rightfully banished along with lobotomy and all the other barbaric treatments from that era. And that's actually the reaction I had when Kitty Dukakis first came to me and told me about the treatment that she had been getting. She and Michael were old friends, and I knew that she had had issues with drugs and alcohol. I knew that she had suffered from depression. I just never imagined that one of the treatments that would be out there that she could have used and did use to great effect was electric shock. And I thought, as a medical reporter, that if it was really surprising to me and that I had no idea that it was making a quiet comeback, that it would be equally surprising and interesting to my readers. So she and I hooked up and agreed to do a collaborative book.
Well, Larry, give us a picture of I'll have to call it electroconvulsive therapy, or what we call electroshock therapy, from its origins. And I was surprised to learn that it doesn't go back to the 19th century from your book, Shock. And is there a difference between what many of us were so horrified about and what's being utilized today?
Sure. Let me take you back through a real brief history. Electric shock started in Italy in 1938. It was something that was discovered accidentally, that actually when patients had convulsions, naturally occurring convulsions with epilepsy and other illnesses, that it had some effect on their mental health as well as their physical health, and the effect could actually be a positive one. And so after lots of experimentation with different drugs to induce the shock, in 1938, a doctor in Italy tried electricity, and it seemed to work. It produced an effect in the patient who was catatonic, brought him back to life. And because there was so little else going on back then in terms of effective treatments in psychiatry, starting in the 1930s, late 30s, and in America in the early 40s, it became the single treatment of choice in mental asylums. Patients who had been put there, essentially warehoused, had none of the antidepressant drugs or the antipsychotics. Those hadn't been invented yet. So from the 40s through the 50s and even into the early 60s, it was widely used. It was used at too high a dose often and used on too many different kinds of patients, but it was about the only thing that would work.
Did it work, in fact?
It worked quite well on lots of patients, on people with depression and lifting them out of depression, on people with schizophrenia, but it also often left behind, because, again, it was used at a high dose and too many treatments, it often left behind a disabling memory loss. But it was you hear people who describe it in its early days have two reactions. One is sort of, geez, this treatment was barbaric in lots of ways. On the other hand, it worked for enough patients that it really gave hope to people where there had been no hope. It was displaced in the late 1960s, early 70s, and throughout the 1970s for two reasons. One is because we developed all these incredible psychopharmaceuticals, the antidepressants we know about, antipsychotics, other drugs. And if you were given a choice of having electricity injected into your brain or popping a pill, just about everybody preferred, understandably, popping a pill. It was also displaced because, as you said in beginning this segment, the image that had been created so effectively by authors and even better by movie makers like Milos Forman in his film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was so compelling and was so scary that people didn't want to do it. The interesting thing is when Ken Kesey wrote the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and certainly by the time Jack Nicholson starred in the movie, that was not what electric shock treatment looked like.
You remind us of the dates of the film and the book, though.
Sure. We're talking in the early 1970s that the Cuckoo's Nest story was first told, and it was by that time, as Ken Kesey, who wrote the book, knew because he worked in a mental asylum, it was not the levitating procedure that left you with an obliterated mind as it did Jack Nicholson. In fact, most people don't realize that what got to Jack Nicholson in the end of the book was, in fact, not electric shock, the treatment he'd been getting throughout the movie. It was a lobotomy, and there was no mention of the word lobotomy in the movie, although there was in the book.
Hmm.
But by then, there were three things that had transformed electric shock treatment. One was oxygen was administered throughout the course of the treatment, limiting the dislocation to the brain. More importantly, in terms of the image of what the procedure actually looked like, anesthesia was administered so the patient was out well before the treatment was administered to their brain, and they were given muscle relaxants so they weren't flailing around on the table. And when I watched Kitty get the treatment a couple times over the last year, it happened so quickly, and the seizure, the electricity that was used to induce its seizure, the whole process happened so quickly that the second hand of my watch moved too fast to actually get a sense of what was going on. The seizure itself happened in the matter of seconds, and the only physical manifestation of it was a toe that twitched up and down. That the muscle relaxant that she had been given ensured that her body didn't move, and it was very difficult to tell that she had even had a seizure. The whole procedure, from the moment that she was put out to the moment where she woke up afterwards, that entire process was under 15 minutes, with the seizure itself under 15 seconds.
Well, Larry Tye is my guest. He, along with Kitty Dukakis, are the authors of Shock, the Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. Larry, are you in a sense a convert to this? Did you have the same sort of prejudices that I have to tell you I still have to some extent? We'll have to talk more. And changed? And if so, or tell us the process of your involvement with this and how your thinking changed, if it did.
The process was that Kitty Dukakis came to me and asked me whether I would help her tell her story. And she was clearly a believer in the thing. She had been getting it for 5 years. She and Michael describe it as her miracle. She was so desperate at the time that she was getting it that she would drink herself into a stupor, and to mask these horrifying symptoms of depression. And when she couldn't find alcohol in the house, she drank rubbing alcohol. Anything that was under the kitchen sink or under the bathroom sink, she would drink if it had any alcohol in it. And she was enough an advocate for the thing. I said to her that I liked her a lot, and I said telling her story was important and I would help her do that, but I would only do it if every other chapter, as she was telling her personal story, I could more generally look at the effect of the treatment on lots of patients. So my chapters looked at the history and, more importantly, at the contemporary medicine and science. I interviewed scores of doctors and more than 100 patients who had had it, and what I said to her is, look, you've had the treatment for better. I want to interview patients who have had it for better and for worse, understand its benefits, understand its risks, And in my chapters, give people a more balanced sense of when the benefits and for whom they might outweigh the risks. And I became a convert to the extent that I now believe this is for people who have run out of other potential treatments, for people whom drugs don't work for or whom they stop working for whom talk therapy is of limited benefit. There's nothing else out there, and I believe electric shock for many of them is an extraordinarily effective treatment. The most effective of the antidepressants generally work on upwards of 60% of the patients they're given to. Electric shock, on average, works for about 75% of people. That doesn't mean it doesn't have side effects, and we can talk about those, but I am totally convinced that if you are depressed, if you've run out of other options, if you are on the verge of suicide, the fastest acting and the singly most effective treatment out there, as the U.S. Surgeon General has concluded, is electric shock.
Now, that was going to be my next question. You said you spoke to doctors. There's also the Surgeon General and other agencies and institutes of the U.S. government. What's the medical establishment and the government agencies that look at this sort of thing? What is their take on it?
Peter, the medical establishment, it's really interesting because I echo Kitty, who says that electric shock is generally discussed today, even today after it's been back for 10 years, it's discussed in whispers. That patients who have had it feel stigmatized enough by their underlying mental illness, and they're doubly stigmatized and afraid of telling anybody that they had this seemingly barbaric treatment, electric shock. Similarly, among doctors, you talk to psychiatrists, you pull them over to a corner and you talk to them quietly, and they will say, everyone in the psychiatric establishment knows that it's about as effective as anything out there, if not more so. And yet, publicly, they're afraid to talk about it a whole lot because they have the same reaction that you did and that I did before I started this book, which is, this is something that people who are in polite company don't talk about because it's a torture. And I think that if you go to leading hospitals in places like Michigan and you talk to doctors at places like the Henry Ford Health Center, at leading health centers around the country and hospitals, they will tell you that for their most severely ill patients, the one thing that is most guaranteed to work is electric shock.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned a couple of Detroit area facilities. I suppose there's people listening that are thinking, man, I've tried everything and I'm still depressed. I have a family member that's close to suicidal. Is this something they can just rush over? I mean, I know you can't do it like just say, hey, I'm here for 5 minutes. Can you do it? What's the procedure that precedes this?
Peter, good question, and the answer is that, first of all, I'm not advocating this for anybody. I'm saying that if people have run out of solutions, they ought to talk to their doctor about whether this is something that could work for them. And the them is people who are severely depressed, people who have mania, people who have bipolar, which is a combination of depression and mania, even people who are schizophrenic or catatonic, lots of different mental illnesses that this can help with. They ought to talk to their doctor. They ought to ask whether their local hospital does electric shock. And what I think is that they'll be surprised that lots of facilities, no hospital that I know anywhere in America is going to go out and advertise among the services that it posts an ad in the newspaper or in radio for. It's not going to say, we're the shock hospital. They, again, do it quietly, often in the basement of the hospital in early morning hours, but they do it, and they do it at a surprising number of hospitals in Michigan and across America. And if somebody is really desperate and nothing else seems to work, this works fast, it often works very effectively, and its main side effect, and this was true in its early days and it's true today to a lesser extent, is memory loss.
Hmm.
That there are procedures for giving the treatment today that are at a lower dose and in a more forgiving form of electricity, but it still can present memory loss. Generally, it's short lasting. It's generally surrounding the time period before and just after the treatment, but for some people, it can last longer, and nobody wants to lose memories.
Well, I know that particularly that in itself can be disturbing. Just think about, you know, you or I when we can't think of something or some period in our life is kind of a blank. So, yeah.
True. That's very scary, and the only thing scarier is taking your own life because your mental illness is so overwhelming. And this, I talk to lots of people. I talk to people who are critics of it and who think the procedure shouldn't be allowed. But I talk to a lot more people, even ones who had memory loss, who said, look, I'm alive to tell you about my memory loss, and therefore the balance for me is, do I want to lose memories? No. Would I prefer to stay, to be alive, rather than have all my memories? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are critics, and very vociferous critics. The people I'm most aware of are the Church of Scientology, who put out these very slick magazines showing the horrors of it and how it was misused and how it was developed in fascist Italy, and because, you know, 1938. Are you familiar with their criticisms?
I'm very familiar, and I spoke to people across the spectrum of the critics and looked at all the literature that the church and everybody else puts out. And I think that if you look at the church, they have a right to their criticism, but they're generally critical of psychiatry generally. They're critical
they
of
are.
Antidepressants and antipsychotics. And if you don't want to go the route of conventional psychiatry, you know, everybody has a right to make that decision. What we're saying is, in this book, is people also should have the right to use a treatment that's available out there and that works so well, and that nobody, the Church of Scientology nor nobody else, should be able to take away an option. You shouldn't force people to have something, and you shouldn't take away their right to choose to have it.
Well, in terms of critics, maybe that was the most loaded. I'm sure there are probably prominent medical people that oppose it. Am I correct? And if so, what are there?
Fewer prominent medical people, the people who I find as the most credible critics are people who have had it and who suffered memory issues from it and who think that it's not worth the risk-benefit trade-off that we were just talking about. And those people, I would say, have a total right to their opinion. They have a right to get out their word to others. There are two things to ask. One is, did they have it in the years in the 70s and 80s when it was a less forgiving form of the treatment? And the second thing is, people can suffer memory loss even with modern-day ECT today. Kitty suffers limited memory loss. But I think that nobody should have a right to sort of take away a treatment from other people who want to give it a try, and particularly one that works so well. And I wish that there were treatments out there. I wish there were antidepressants that had no side effects. I wish that we could all pop a pill and know that it was going to take away our illness. The only reason people are considering ECT is because so many times other things don't work, and they're really on the edge.
Again, the kitty involved here is Kitty Dukakis, wife of Michael Dukakis, the Democratic Party's 1988 candidate, and my guest, Larry Tye. The book is Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. And I said that you, Larry Tye, had been on the show. I don't know if I mentioned that it was with your book, Rising from the Rails, an extraordinary account of the Black Pullman Porters from, my memory, 1880s, wasn't it, up until...
It was the 1940s all the way through. The 1880s, for a full 100 years of riding on the rails in these Pullman cars.
An extraordinary account. This is as well, and you spoke to 100 ECT patients, and you said the ones that were, you said about 75% of them were very affirmative of it. The other 25%, were they just disappointed, or were they vociferous?
Let me clarify. I spoke to 100, and they didn't break down exactly the 75-25. The 75-25, I should have been clearer, is from all the scientific studies done. On average, about 75% of patients report that it substantially relieves their symptoms. It is not a cure, it's a treatment, but it gives them a critical short-term relief to figure out what next to do. The 25% are ones who, this is not a question of side effects, it's a question of it not working on their underlying depression or other illness. And 25% sounds like a substantial failure rate, and it is, and it's an unfortunate one. It just so happens that the failure rates for drugs approximate 40% for most of them, or 50%. And so the idea that you can take a group who are among the sickest of the mentally ill and who have often tried all kinds of other treatments, and that you have something that's available to help 75% of them, that is extraordinary. And I think that the it's not a question of my saying it'll work for them. It's a question of it giving them at least some hope of something working where nothing else is.
You mentioned about a short-term cure. So, and also you mentioned about Kitty Dukakis taking several treatments. So how frequently are these administered?
Good question, and the answer is it depends on the individual. In Kitty Dukakis's case, her depression comes back every 8 months, almost like clockwork. That's called her cycle, and she cycles into depression at that kind of a rate. She then goes through 6 individual sessions of shock treatment, spaced out 3 a week over 2 weeks. Generally, people who get it over a course of 2 to 3 weeks. They get 6 to 12 treatments. And what happens after that hopefully pulls them out of the really critical period of the illness, is they do either of 2 things. They then find a drug that will work to perpetuate this relief that they're getting, or they get an ongoing basis electric shock. And electric shock meaning maybe twice a month and then once a month. And they call that either continuation or maintenance shock treatment, where you're getting it to maintain the remission that you've had from your severe symptoms. So shock, like drugs, short-term relief. You stop taking it. You expect for most people the symptoms to come back. Sometimes they come back right away. Sometimes they come back in a matter of months. You got to look for something longer term. But pulling people back from the edge is what this does.
Now, pardon me, you mentioned in your book, Shock, a number of prominent people had electroshock therapy administered to them. Some of them, obviously, from when they lived, like Ernest Hemingway, must have been back in sort of when stronger shocks were administered.
Absolutely, and Hemingway had it to bad effect. He, with him, he blamed it for wiping out big periods of his memory. To a writer, there's nothing more critical than their memory, and critics often say that this is what led to Hemingway's suicide. I don't know whether it did or it didn't. His records are sealed. I talked to his biographer, who was also his friend, who says, look, there are 100 reasons why Hemingway committed suicide, and to pick out electric shock, the fact that he had shock and not long after committed suicide, is not fair to make that causal connection, and that Hemingway had a lot of horrible things going on in his life that he decided to take his life. But lots of prominent people had it. One of the people we talk about, a modern-day writer who had it more recently than Hemingway, is William Styron. Particularly the first time he had it, it had great effect, great positive effect for him. The second time, it was less effective. Lots of prominent people, generally, though, they're not coming out and saying, you know, putting up the hand and saying, I had shock treatment. We see all kinds of confessionals of people talking about the mental illness that they suffered in a way to try to reduce that stigma. Kitty is the first really prominent person who's come out and told her complete story about not just the illness, but about the treatment. And as she says, it's unfair that people should suffer this double whammy or double stigma of being condemned because they're mentally ill and then being condemned again because they try a treatment that some people think doesn't look too pretty.
Now, with a lot of procedures, when you speak to a doctor or even a dentist or an ophthalmologist, I've had the experience that you say something to them about 5 years ago, and they said, oh, that was so primitive. But every point we're at, we're at state-of-the-art today, by definition. But it is electroconvulsive therapy in a process of development? Does it have a way to go yet, do you think?
It's definitely in a process of perpetual refinement. Refinement in lots of ways. Kitty and most patients who start out with it today start out with the electrodes on one side of their head rather than on both, trying to preserve the memory storing part of the brain. So lower impact on memories by doing it that way. There are things that they're playing with in terms of the pulse that they use to try to use a lower impact part. The refinement is perpetual. The refinement is not just with electric shock, but they're trying magnetic forms of the therapy that would be even lower intrusion. They're trying to do things that maintain the effectiveness while making the treatment more forgiving. One of the good pieces of news with shock treatment is that it's been around nearly 70 years, which means that unlike many of the drugs, which are new enough that we're not quite sure what their long-term effect is, shock treatment we've seen for a full 70 years, and we can measure not just the short-term effects, but the long-term effects of the treatment.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, the book is Shock, The Healing Power of Electroconvulsive Therapy. The long subtitle is A Journalist's Account of Psychiatry's Most Controversial Treatment and a Moving Portrait of One Woman's Life-Changing Experience. That woman is Kitty Dukakis, and our guest has been Larry Tai. Again, I would highly recommend the book. Is it, I just have a, let's see, it is, because I have a, what do we call it, an uncorrected proof for limited distribution. So it's published by Penguin, is it?
It's published by a division of Penguin called Avery. People can find it on the Penguin website, on Amazon, and in their local bookstore. It's been out in bookstores now for a couple weeks, and it should be available anywhere.
All right, and again, I would, if you, still in circulation is a number of Larry Tai's wonderful books, including Rising from the Rails, also the father of Spin and Another Homelands as well. Larry Tai, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It's been great to be back with you, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you. Let's talk about economics. So many things going on in the world that distract us from what's happening to our pocketbooks, which translates into our families, to our neighborhoods, to our communities, to our state. Extraordinarily important, obviously, this is all. So let's get somebody that knows this cold. He's going to be in our town. His name is Jeff Foe. He is the founder of the Economic Policy Policy Institute. It's an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute, or what they call a think tank. It researches the impact of economic trends and policies on, pardon me, on working people in the United States and around the world. Jeff Foe, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. I should say welcome back.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here again.
Hey, what does that mean, working people? Why is that thrown in? You, people usually just talk about the economy.
Yeah, well, it's important to distinguish between who gets what. And what we've seen over the last couple of decades, really, is that the division of the benefits of the economy that go to people who have to work for a living. And, you know, I mean people who have to go out every day and earn enough to put the bread on the table and pay the rent. The division between the people who have to work for a living, who are the majority of Americans, and people who make a living by investing or managing large corporations, the division of income and wealth has been steadily moving from workers to corporate investors. And we saw that, we picked up that trend as much as 15, 20 years ago. And when we first started talking about it, people said, oh, you know, that can't be true. But now almost everybody agrees that the average American worker is not only losing his or her share of the revenues that go into businesses and enterprises, but they're actually in absolute terms doing worse. For a long time, real wages, and by real wages I mean, you know, what's in your paycheck adjusted for the cost of living. Obviously, if you get a 4% raise and the cost of living goes up 4%, you're not doing any better. So if you adjust for all that, it turns out that Americans who work for a living have their wages have been stagnant for the last 15 years, and in the last few years, especially since 2001, they've actually declined. On the other hand, if you look at if you put all Americans in a sort of a row and you picked out according to their income, the people at the very end, that is the top, who are getting the most money, have done very, very well. And I don't even mean, you know, sort of the top 20%. I'm talking about the top 1%. They're off the charts, 600% or more increases in income, while the rest of us have remained flat or are doing worse. Now, you know, the way we measure this is that you look at people of the same age and the same general occupation, you know, in one period of time, say 2005. Versus how people, you know, at that same age and occupation were doing 15 years before. So one of the things that happens is that people, as people get older until they reach about 45 or 50, they're doing a little better each year. That's just natural. But if you take back and look at, you know, what's happening to working people over time, each decade, people at the same age, same occupation, are doing a little bit worse.
My guest in the Peter Werby Show is Jeff Foe, and he is going to be in town tomorrow, Monday, October 16th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Bernath Auditorium at the Wayne State University Library. That's on the Gullen Mall. It's in Detroit. For more information, you can contact the Labor Studies Center at 313-577-2191. Now, Jeff, one of the things that you said I think was very important, a lot of times when I kind of mobilize the best I can, often you using the Economic Policy Institute numbers to support my contention that things are not going so well. They'll say, "Hey, I was making $4 an hour as a bag boy in a supermarket, and now I'm a lawyer, so I'm doing a lot better." So it's important. I mean, that's apples and oranges, isn't it?
Right. Somebody goes from a bag boy to a lawyer, is probably doing better, but that's pretty rare. One of the other things that we know from the numbers is that America, used to be a place of great upward mobility. People used to go from bag boy, up the scale. But over the last 15, 20 years, you're more likely, not to do better than your parents in terms of, where you are in the distribution of income and wealth, and therefore, where you are in society, than in the past. I did better than my father at every sort of stage of my life, and I always thought it was because I was smarter and better looking than my father. Turns out he was stupid enough to be born in time for the Great Depression. I was smart enough to be born in time for just those years, when I came into the labor force in the 60s and the 70s when things were going well for everybody. My kids are facing a world that is beginning to look like the world my father faced. And part of that has to do with, what we call globalization. I've just written this book called The Global Class War. And it turns out that one of the major things that's changed is that with these trade agreements and with globalization, you find that companies who used to think in terms of their future, being the same or being linked to the future of their workers and their American customers, no longer think that. Back in the turn of the century, turn of the last century, Henry Ford, around somewhere like 1915, 1920, raised the pay of auto workers, and not a great deal, but a little bit. And his Wall Street friend said, "What are you doing, paying these people $5 a day?" And Ford said, "Well, they're making the cars, and they're going to have to buy the cars, too." And, that was a pretty good insight. And he could say that and think that way because, we were all in the same economy in America. And by the 1930s, we learned that piece of wisdom and that, the economy depended not just on the investor, but on the worker who was going to be the consumer and was going to buy those cars. A friend of mine once said, who was in the textile business, once said, I said, "What do you look for, Herb, when you're going to invest and create some jobs?" And he said, "Well, I don't care what the tax rate is." He said, "I don't even care what the interest rate is. What I care about are customers coming in the door with money in their pockets to buy my goods." So, that was conventional wisdom, and we all understood that. It took us a long time, but by the end of the 1930s, World War II, and then afterwards, we sort of got that. And that was the time when profits went up, wages went up, labor productivity went up, and sort of everybody went up together.
Well, there was a sharing. The productivity, the gains from it were shared with the people who did the work.
Absolutely. It was, and so everybody was benefiting, and it was sort of mutual dependence on the part of the employers and the employees. But then something started to happen. And what started to happen is that those companies became global. And, once they became global, they no longer depended on American workers. And gradually, as they look into the future, they're no longer depending, thinking they're going to depend on American customers. So the link between these companies and the average American has been disconnected. And you see it, 100 years later, Henry Ford's Motor Company, the CEO, said, "Well, we're not an American company. When we're in America, we're an American company. When we're in Brazil, we're a Brazilian company. When we're in Germany, we're a German company. And the head of Cisco Systems, which you know, is a high-tech poster boy for America's future, this guy 2 months ago said, our strategy is to become a Chinese company.
Boo!
So what you've suddenly got is that social contract, as some people called it, and it was, you know, started with the New Deal in the 1930s, in which there was an agreement, a sort of an arrangement among, you know, classes, among economic classes, the rich, the middle class, the workers, that everybody who was willing to get up and go to work in the morning and, you know, do a decent day's work was going to benefit. We were going to all share that because we were all in America, and that's, you know, the place where that gave us all these opportunities. But now you see these companies going offshore. And once they go offshore, and once they think of the world as their place and not America, then it suddenly changes. And that change is showing up in wages, in economic insecurity, in all of these things that are beginning to fraying the standard of living of the average American worker. So it's been going on for some time. We've been picking up in the numbers, and now it's quite clear that that this is a major trend. You know, some people say, well, how can, if things are so bad, when you look around, how can they look so good? You know, you go to the shopping mall and there's, you know, people buying stuff.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, all this home construction, and everybody's putting on additions.
And both things are true. And the reason it looks so good, I mean, you go to Starbucks and you're paying $4 for a cup of coffee, for God's sake, and people are doing it. And the reason is a four-letter word, debt. American consumers, because their real wages have been flat, find themselves borrowing more and borrowing more and borrowing more to keep up their living standards. America as a whole, our country, is borrowing huge amounts of money from the rest of the world just so that we can keep spending at those shopping malls. So that, you know, for the last 25 years, we have been buying from the rest of the world more than we've been selling it. And so it's the familiar trade deficit, which is now completely out of control. And the reason we've gotten away with that is that we've been able to borrow from these other countries. So, for example, you know, you go to the store and half of the stuff you see is made in China. Well, the Chinese get the dollars from that, and then they lend it back to American banks and American credit card companies and the American government. And that money then flows back through the economy, so that we're running on this gas of debt. And the problem is that our debts are rising faster than our income. And you don't have to be an economist. You don't have to, you know, have gone beyond the sixth or seventh grade to know that you can't keep that going on forever.
Well, I do know that, and it surprises me that things go in this direction, because turning the old aphorism on its head about, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich? If they're so rich, how come they're not smart? Do they have just such a short-run view of the world? I mean,
that's the key question. You ask yourself, how can this be true? I mean, these smart people running Washington, these smart people run these companies. The thing is that these smart people running these countries, they don't see the future in the United States anymore. They see their future in the world. When the guy who runs Cisco Systems says, we want to be a Chinese company, he sees that the Chinese are outproducing us. The Chinese are now taking our markets, and that's where the action is going to be. Now, he may be an American. He may live in a nice, you know, rich suburb, probably some gated community full of, you know, guards, but he's going to be okay. And his kids are going to be okay because he's already invested in China. But that's where the investment has gone. Now you say, well, wait a minute, these guys in Washington, you know, are supposed to protect us from all of this, right? I mean, sure. This is a democracy. We vote for these people. But the kicker in this is that the most powerful people in Washington are the multinational corporations who are doing this. And they and the press, the you know, the media, the policy people, the talking heads on TV, they keep referring to these people as American corporations. And so we think, hey, well, you know, if they do well, we're going to do well. What's good for General Motors is good for America. But gradually these people are consider themselves global corporations, not American corporations. And that's the problem. They are the most powerful people in Washington. And so it's no surprise that you end up with these trade agreements and these international deals which provide the benefits to the multinational corporations and leave, you know, the American mm-hmm. worker in the dust.
You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest, Jeff Foe, will be in Detroit tomorrow, Monday, October 16th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. It's going to be at the Bernath Auditorium at Wayne State University on Gullen Mall in Detroit. If you're missing all this, driving or something, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and go to the calendar, and that will give you the information. Jeff is the founder of the Economic Policy Institute, and you can go to epi.org, where I think the information is there as well. Now, there's certain words that I can't say on the air, as you full well know, and everyone does, but actually, Jeff Foe, you said one that you know, that usually isn't heard phrase, class war. Your online, well, the book actually is, there's a news release about it. The Global Class War, How America Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back. But class war, boy, you start saying that and people are getting all upset.
Yeah, well, you know, it's there's no other phrase that tells it like it is. It's, you know, America's always had classes. I mean, we, you know, we don't like to admit it, but I think most of your listeners and most people in America understand that, you know, that there are people with wealth and people with economic power, and, you know, then there are people with a little bit of it, and then there's people with none of it. And it's always been the case. But as long as we were all together in an American economy, you know, everybody, the people at the top were sort of forced to share. It took a long time to get them to force them to do that. But, you know, after a while, everybody understood that everybody's got a little bit. Enough has to trickle down from the top, as it were, so that, you know, there are opportunities for everybody. But again, this has been cut off by what we call globalization, at least the way that we're pursuing this globalization with all these trade deals. And so, you know, for about, I'd say maybe 50 or 60 years, the tensions between people of different income levels in America was muted. It was muted because it was muted by things like Social Security, unemployment compensation, later Medicare, you know, the development and certainly trade unions who could represent individuals who were powerless in front of the boss and could represent them collectively. Now you see they're undermining all of that, and they're undermining it because they, you know, they can. Before they'd worry, for a while they worried about, you know, my God, is capitalism versus communism. So, you know, we got to keep our workers happy. And then it was, you know, it was simply that it just made sense for us to have an economy where the money circulated and it went from the investors to the workers back to the shareholders. The custom workers became customers. You know, it was a sort of a virtuous circle. But again, now that they can go other places, they feel they don't need the average American. And you see, you know, we're talking before about how productivity was rising all those good years, and wages were rising with it. In other words, what workers were making, they got more efficient, they were getting some of the benefits of that. And, of course, corporations were more profitable.
Mm-hmm.
But now you see especially in the last decade or so, this huge gap between its productivity, labor productivity keeps going up, workers keep getting more efficient, but they're not sharing in the benefits. And one of the most interesting things to do is to look at the three countries involved in NAFTA, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And when you look at the gap between labor productivity and wages, it's growing wider in all three countries. And what that tells me is that the class system, as it were, now crosses borders. NAFTA, as you know, was a so-called free trade deal, but it really was a deal that protected investors in all three countries. So NAFTA was a deal that favored capital in all three countries. And if you ask yourself, well, who won and who lost? Did Canada win or lose? Or the U.S. win or lose? Or Mexico win or lose? It's not a very useful question, because the numbers show us that the rich in all three countries gained and working people in all three countries lost. Now, one of the implications of this.
Hey, Jeff, let me do this. You know, I would advise people, because I'm looking at the clock and it's running out quickly.
Right.
Best thing to do, because this is very complex. One of the good ideas would be to look at Jeff Foh's book, The Global Class War. And there's about 100 questions I have, but since I don't think everyone listening is going to be able to get down to Wayne State University Monday night, quickly, if you could just weigh in a little, because part of the subtitle of your book is about the bipartisan elite. We have a gubernatorial race here. Governor Granholm saying that, you know, she's done everything she could under the situation, and charging Dick DeVos with being part of the globalizing effort that's lost jobs. And is there a good guy and a bad guy here, or are they part of the bipartisan elite?
Well, I think over the last 20 years, I'm a registered Democrat, but I'd be lying to you if I said this was just a Republican-Democratic issue. It depends on NAFTA, for example, was sponsored by was a Ronald Reagan idea. People don't usually know that. So Ronald Reagan idea was negotiated by George Bush the first and was delivered by Bill Clinton. So that, you know, it's a question of elites, and elites have been drawn from both parties. Things have gotten a lot worse over the last 6 years. There's no question about that. The trade deficit is, as I said before, is blown out of control. The wages and the gap between wages and productivity have gotten worse. But this has been going on for a while, and it's about elites in Washington who are much more responsive to these large corporations who don't consider themselves American anymore. And it's not that I'm just accusing them of something horrible. They say it themselves. When the head of Cisco Systems says, we want to be a Chinese company, boy, that should be ringing a bell for every American.
Well, one of the ways, and we only have about a minute left or so, one of the ways I know that the Economic Policy Institute that you founded thinks there can be a somewhat of a readjustment here is to raise the minimum wage. Now, there has been a state raise in Michigan. I think it's up around $7 an hour now as of October 1st. Is this one of the things you're going to tell the audience at Wayne State tomorrow?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things we have to do. We certainly need to raise the minimum wage. But we also, in the spring, the reauthorization of the president's authority to go and make these trade deals comes up. And I think we're going to see a big fight over that. What we need to do, I believe, what we need to do is stop making these trade deals, because every time we make them, we import more than we export, and our trade deficit gets worse, and the money we need to borrow from China gets greater. So one of the things we need to do is stop what we're doing now and renegotiate some of this stuff so that we can get our books back into balance and we can bring those jobs. And more importantly, I think, we can make sure that the jobs of the future get located here.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to stop this interview right now.
Oh, I've got another 4 hours.
I know you do. And you get an hour and a half Monday, October 16th. That's tomorrow, 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Wayne State University Library in Detroit. And if you've missed any of the directions or anything like that, go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. More in Jeff Foe's book, The Global Class War, How America Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back. You can go to their website, the Economic Policy Institute, at epi.org. Jeff Foe, I will see you Monday night.
See you then. Thank you.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.